brought to you by the Cannabis Bee Network.
Here is the Cannabis Entrepreneur Show with your host, Scott Jacobs.
Hello, listeners. How's it going today? This is the Cannabis Entrepreneur News, episode 013-425-2014. All right, let's roll into article number one. Is pot-related marketing the next big gold rush? Take it away.
Is pot-related marketing the next big gold rush? By Marion Salzman. Source, Forbes. On the high holiday yesterday/20, that is why friend and PR client Jason Hairston, the young entrepreneur behind the successful Nugget Spot in New York City, happily shared an article on Facebook. It was a Thrillist roundup of the city's top 32 places to cure the holiday munchies. Turns out Hairston Ho's deep-fried nuggets of chicken, fish, pork, polenta and cheese appeal to plenty of sober adults, too, as a lot of company in making high-end stoner food. The list includes single-focus restaurants specializing in biscuits, pudding, bacon, cheese fries and burgers with donuts for buns. While many of them are in bar-heavy neighborhoods, their target demographic might very well have a different drug of choice. They're just one segment of the growing marijuana industrial complex. Everyone is putting a huge emphasis on how to monetize weed. Now that recreational marijuana is legal in 2 states, medical marijuana in 18 more and D.C., and many other states including New York, where law enforcement has long largely looked away looking at legalizing one or both, businesses of all stripes and sizes are trying to get in on the action. As Robert Fichtel, president and CEO of Advanced Cannabis Solutions, a Colorado Springs, Colo, company that leases spaces for growing marijuana, told Bloomberg Businessweek in January, everybody is running toward this as the next entrepreneurial wavy green rush. His was one of a dozen companies seeking funding from about 70 investors at a Las Vegas meeting put together by the ArcView Group, an investment firm that's centered around the marijuana industry. ArcView projects that the market for legal marijuana will reach $2.34 billion in 2014. And that doesn't even count all of Hairston's nuggets. When you consider the countless peripheral businesses that stand to benefit from the growing acceptance of the drug, Atchers predicted the return of classified advertising and new growth for Colorado's alt weeklies, head shops have seen business boom, garden shops found new markets and junk food sales quite likely went up. Tease clear that the marijuana business has an overall valuation much higher than $2.34 billion. There are the little guys, like Colorado blogger Nathan Hammond, who announced in a pre-legalization post that his new blog was an effort at monetizing the marijuana industry without having to sell the stuff. And raised amusing questions about marijuana SEO. What do stoners punch into Google anyway? But this isn't just a big joke. The media is taking notice. Not long ago, at a panel discussion at the Society of American Business Editors and Writers Spring Conference, Al Olson, a senior editor at NBC, said he has been embarrassed by a lot of the media's coverage of the marijuana industry. It's time to drop the Cheech and Chong jokes. It's time to drop the reefer madness, he said. It's time to cover this like a real business. At the same conference, Brendan Kennedy, CEO of Privateer Holdings, a private equity firm that invests in the legal marijuana industry, said 81% of Americans believe medical cannabis should be legal if a doctor prescribes it. He added, as a crop, it's bigger than corn, it's bigger than soybeans, it's almost as big as corn and soybeans together. Privateer itself is certainly no joke. The firm is set to raise more than $50 million in its latest round of fundraising by the end of next month, which will more than double the $22 million Privateer has raised to date. New investments include some from several institutional investors who had previously avoided the industry, and the pace has even surprised Kennedy, according to an article in the online newspaper Marijuana Business Daily itself, a business that's built on monetizing the drug. Privateer has invested its current funds in companies ranging from crop producers to processing and shipping companies to a strain review website. At the same time, publicly traded cannabis companies that had shied away from actual marijuana before think hemp-based products and growing equipment are starting to get more directly into the medical marijuana market, according to another Marijuana Business Daily article. That's both because of growing public acceptance of the drug and because of a shift in regulations and laws surrounding it, and a perception of less risk. Based on my conversations with companies that are public and private, it's likely that we're going to see licensing models emerge, whereby proprietary strains, extraction processes or edible brands are put into public company vehicles, the article quoted Alan Brockstein, a chartered financial analyst who runs a cannabis-focused stock website for investors. We are headed in this direction because investors want it that badly. In the meantime, restaurateurs can happily promote their high-end junk food in their 420th specials. Bloggers and reviewers can sell advertising to new marijuana businesses. It gives a whole new meaning to green marketing.
Article number 2, Pot Economics. What's the future of the American marijuana market? Take it away.
Pot Economics, What's the Future of the American Marijuana Market? By Dan Schneider. Source, Truth Out. In November 2012, voters in Colorado and Washington State made historic decisions to legalize marijuana for recreational sale and use, flying in the face of anti-pot moralists, drug warriors, and a century's worth of prohibitionist policy. At the start of this year, these policies began to take effect, with pot shops opening for business for the first time on this side of the Atlantic. Once thought to be a mere pipe dream, legalization now seems like an inevitability. At the time of this writing, no fewer than 11 states are considering some form of legislation to allow marijuana to be sold over the counter, and at least a dozen others are considering decriminalization or medical marijuana measures. Tired of federal foot-dragging, states as disparate as Alaska, New Mexico, and Vermont are cautiously weighing the potential benefits of legalization, persuaded not only by abstract arguments about individual liberty but also by hopes of pumping money into their economies. Meanwhile, advocates have been quick to promote marijuana as just the medicine states need to fill their coffers, create new jobs, and cut costs by keeping non-violent drug offenders out of jail. See below, the drug war, wasting lives and dollars. But what would the economic impact of widespread legalization be? There are dozens of factors to consider, particularly on the revenue side of the equation, how many people will be consuming marijuana, and how much. What states stand to benefit most from growing it? Will big business take over its production and sale, or will it remain in the hands of independent growers and dealers? And how large, in dollar terms, might this whole sector end up? The jury is still out on what the ultimate financial impact of legalization would be, but in the past few years a growing body of research has explored the possible contours of a new marijuana economy. This, combined with some publicly available data and the wisdom of a few folks who have watched the legalization movement grow over the last 40 years, can give us a good sense of how the plant might or might not live up to its proponents' expectations. It seems like high time for a little lesson in pot economics. Out of the shadows. Because marijuana is currently grown, distributed, and sold almost entirely on the black market and is used largely out of the public eye, assessing the value of the national market for marijuana including imports and non-recreational uses, such as hemp fiber, is tricky. The trade journal Medical Marijuana Business Daily currently estimates that a fully legalized cannabis market could be as large as $46 billion per year, while more conservative observers peg it at anywhere between $10 billion and $40 billion. There are about 7.6 million frequent marijuana smokers in the United States, according to the 2012 National Survey on Drug Use and Health. Nearly 23.9 million Americans use the drug semi-regularly. Marijuana is sold widely on the black market, and is readily available on street corners, in bars and nightclubs, and in high school hallways as 80% of students reported to the National Institute on Drug Abuse in 2012. Except for the relatively small number of people who have purchased medical marijuana through licensed dispensaries, the vast majority of these users buy their weed on this black market either directly from dealers or from friends with access to a dealer. In a world where marijuana is legal to buy and possess, this would not likely be the case for long. Assuming that demand for the drug remains relatively stable, see below, the demand question, a legal marketplace for marijuana will likely replicate the current distribution system for alcohol and be sold in stores with special permits. Where exactly it could be sold would largely be a matter for state and local regulators to decide, just as it currently is with alcohol. Municipalities might allow lower-strength varieties to be sold in corner stores like beer and wine are in many states or coffee shops la Amsterdam, but it's virtually certain that any store selling any quantity or type of weed would need to get a special license. Whatever the market size, the governments of Colorado and Washington are hoping that taxing the drug will help to bring in some badly needed revenue. Washington placed a 25% excise tax on marijuana with its new law, and Colorado voters passed Proposition AA in November to approve a 15% excise tax and a 10% sales tax on recreational marijuana. These measures are expected to raise hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue for each state, including a projected $500 million for Washington alone by 2015. A study by the RAND Corporation's Drug Policy Research Center describes marijuana buyers as a Walmart, not a Whole Foods market, generally preferring the less expensive Mexican strains to higher quality bud from Northern California. However, the market for domestic marijuana has expanded in recent years. As NPR reported in 2011, commercial prices for marijuana in areas like California have been falling for years, down to as low as $2,500 per pound, as a crop of new suppliers has sprouted up. This brings up the issue of whether marijuana will be allowed to move legally through international trade channels, just as alcohol is today. If marijuana is approved for importation, this could certainly drive down its price in the United States, just as Mexican imports already do. But Mexico isn't the only player in the game. This fall, Uruguay boldly announced that it would begin to allow the use and sale of legal, regulated marijuana nationwide, at the astonishingly low price of $1 per gram compared to $15 or more per gram here. Tariffs and added costs for packaging, shipping, and distribution would certainly bring the costs up on its way to the United States, but if other countries follow Uruguay's example, U.S. producers may have to lower prices to compete. So while questions about who's going to actually buy this newly legal good are of interest to regulators looking to collect taxes on marijuana to fund state and local initiatives, both Colorado and Washington have promised to spend millions of the initial revenue on education, they are likely to be affected by the rise of a legal supply of cannabis, both at home and abroad. A supply that comes, of course, from the farm. Growth market. Although it has been illegal to grow marijuana in the United States for nearly a century, renegade grow-ops have persisted in the face of draconian crackdowns by local law enforcement and the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA. In 2012 alone, the DEA eradicated just under 4 million plants, down from 6.7 million in 2011, over 92% of which came from outdoor grow operations. Nevertheless, ineffective enforcement policies and crafty concealment techniques have allowed farmers to continually move their product through back-channel distributors across the country. In order to flourish in the outdoors, the cannabis plant requires fertile soil that is slightly acidic, daytime temperatures between 75 and 86 degrees Fahrenheit, and at least 12 hours of sunlight per day. There are numerous strains, which can be grown in somewhat different climates, and for the most part marijuana can be grown on a large scale throughout most of the United States during the summer months. While property values, local water quality, and the timeline of legalization in each state will ultimately determine which states are able to take advantage of this new cash crop, we may already have an idea of who will be the biggest contender in the fight to be to marijuana what Georgia is to peanuts. In 2006, John Gitman, a former head of the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws (NORML) and an adjunct professor of public administration at Shepherd University in West Virginia, published a paper estimating the scale of American marijuana production. Through an analysis of government eradication efforts over the prior 3 years, Gitman found that marijuana would be one of the largest cash crops in the United States if it were legal, and was already the top cash crop in 12 states, one of the top three cash crops in 30 states, and one of the top five cash crops in 39 states. In addition, five states, California, Tennessee, Kentucky, Hawaii, and Washington, had marijuana crops worth over $1 billion, with the national pop crop worth more than our national soybean and wheat crops combined. Not all of the money to be made will come from selling marijuana to consumers as a drug. While only the female buds of the plant Cannabis sativa contain adequate levels of the chemical THC tetra-9-hydrocannabinol to cause a high, the rest of the plant has a variety of applications that may pique the interest of small and big business alike. Hemp, as the non-intoxicating parts of the cannabis plant are called, is used in over 25,000 products worldwide, according to a 2013 report from the Congressional Research Service, and is used frequently in products sold by companies like The Body Shop and Whole Foods, which are forced to import their hemp products due to U.S. laws prohibiting the cultivation of any kind of cannabis. The same report estimated the current size of the U.S. hemp market at about $500 million. With a large potential to grow should its products be more widely available for sale both inside and outside of the United States. From the corner to the boardroom? These mouth-watering figures have been and will likely continue to be a part of the argument made by politicians and business types in favor of making marijuana legal. But it's important to put them in perspective, and consider who really stands to gain. It's not yet clear whether American pot growing and selling will, in the future, be managed by a dispersed network of independent producers or fall into the hands of large corporations. Put simply, will smokers be buying from mom and pop's pot shop, or going down to the corner store to buy a pack of Marlboro Greens in August 2013, A young entrepreneur named Brian Leorwinger made digital headlines when a wacky commercial for his new company Prohibition Brands premiered, featuring Leorwinger sporting a cowboy outfit and hokey southern accent. In it, Leorwinger touted what he saw as an oncoming green rush in the marijuana industry as part of a pitch to raise up to $50 million through venture capital groups, crowdfunding sites, and investors. Although most media outlets made light of the crass humor and sexy cowgirls Leorwinger used in the commercial, it was interesting how the two-minute video put a face, in this case, a mustachioed face, on the fast-growing realm of big marijuana that is, corporate production of legal marijuana. When I interviewed Alan St. Pierre, the executive director of NORNL and a marijuana advocate for several decades, he laughed at the mention of Leorwinger's antics, but said that the emergence of figures like him wasn't surprising. According to St. Pierre, the new generation of pot entrepreneurs is more motivated by monetary gains than their older, rogue counterparts, and often come from much different backgrounds. These people have C versus not based on being the toughest guy on the block, but from having gone to Yale and Harvard, he said. Not that St. Pierre believes big business should be shunned. In the past decade, many legalization advocates like NORNL have been among the biggest proponents of a marriage between big business and marijuana, seeing a so-called free market approach as vital to marijuana's successful transition from the black market. Do we gird against the idea of corporate tobacco? Yeah, because that industry has been shown to be really malevolent, says St. Pierre. But NORNL doesn't think that corporations are evil, or that capitalism is bad. There are other ominous signs of marijuana's oncoming corporatization on the horizon. Last May, former Microsoft manager Jamin Chively appeared side-by-side with former Mexican president and corporate executive Vicente Fox to promote the launch of his own weed company, Diego Pellicer. To Chively, Pellicer could position itself early on to become the first national, Starbucks-like brand associated with marijuana, if it is able to get its financial ducks in a row and avoid the ire of the DEA. Even the weed magazine High Times has started its own $100 million private equity fund in anticipation of a coming windfall. But just as the inaugural class of legal pop capitalists begins to rise, there are more than a few who see big business interests as anathema to the spirit of drug policy reform. My greatest apprehension is that profit, and only profit, will become the main determining factor in how cannabis is distributed, said Steve D'Angelo, co-founder and executive director of Oakland's Harborside Health Center, the largest medical marijuana dispensary in California. D'Angelo says that while he understands that the mainstreaming of marijuana sales will inevitably lead some to seek wild profits, he fears for the day when weed will be sold not by an informed specialist but by an indifferent cashier at 7-Eleven or Walmart. To him, the not-for-profit model developed by Harborside, which puts the needs of his patients ahead of profit and the form of free patient services and charitable donations to the community, will be much better. At Harborside, this includes not only providing marijuana to those in need, but wellness services, a library, a grow-your-own seminar, a holistic care clinic, and a volunteer arrangement that allows needy patients to receive a gram of medicine in exchange for every hour put in. A system like this could serve as a community-centric model for future recreational sales. A profit-focused operation run according to the big marijuana ethos may only be interested in meeting its quarterly sales projections. If you have a non-profit environment, you're more likely to attract operators who are really going to be dedicated to doing what's best for society, and not putting the bottom line first, he said. Instead of being offered a variety of services to benefit people, they'll be moved in and out as quickly as possible. It should be noted that Harborside is not a legally registered, tax-exempt non-profit. D'Angelo merely operates not-for-profit. Due to marijuana's current status under federal law, the IRS will not allow medical marijuana dispensaries to seek non-profit status. But St. Pierre and others argue that medical dispensary owners like D'Angelo are merely businessmen themselves, looking to protect existing market share by badmouthing new competition. One could hardly make the same claim about Scott Grayson, executive director of the Arcata, Calif-based conservation group Friends of Eel River. Situated on the coastline of the notorious marijuana farming Humboldt County, Grayson's organization has witnessed firsthand some of the highs and lows for this new industry as it's blossomed from a small handful of ex-hippies and cartel affiliates to a full-blown source of regional livelihood. We see that there are big groups waiting in the wings, ready to come in and start producing at large scale, Grayson said. I think that's a pretty poor public policy choice. Keeping it out of the hands of the corporations is one of the things we can do that makes sense. Of particular concern to Grayson is the environmental impact that large corporate producers could have, especially if met with lax, unspecific regulations for growing ever larger crops. Many grow operations already make use of pesticides, rodenticides, and other chemicals potentially harmful to humans. With a $100 million dollar crop at stake, a company like Prohibition Brands or Diego Pellicer has a strong incentive to use such chemicals and cut other corners in search of maximum profits, according to Grayson. But he stresses that not all is lost. Local government initiatives in Humboldt and Mendocino counties have proven promising to advocates for a sustainable, independent producer-oriented pot industry, with groups like the Emerald Growers Association lending their support in the effort to keep homegrown truly homegrown. As to whether or not marijuana will ultimately go the way of alcohol and tobacco with such an enticing multi-billion dollar carrot dangling on the horizon, Grayson gives the only answer he can so early in the game: we'll see. For the broader legalized market, the future may come sooner than some might think, given how much interest has been stoked by the ongoing experiments in Colorado and Washington. Those still skeptical of the march towards legalization and regulation ought to understand that the current early stage is the best time to shape the industry's future character. Certainly not later, when entrenched interests will be fighting tooth and nail to protect their slices of the pie. So for anyone with an alternative view of what the future landscape ought to look like, Heather informal, independent growers and sellers, non-profit and community-oriented organizations, or a small business, he time is ripe to get ahead of the would-be cannabis carpetbaggers.
Article number 3. Experts gauge hurdles of medical marijuana business. Take it away.
Experts gauge hurdles of medical marijuana business. By David Ferrara. Source, Las Vegas Review Journal. Joining the green rush is going to take a lot of green. You need money, you need a great team, and you need a great location, said attorney and medical marijuana advocate Bruce Gale. Let me rephrase that. You need a location. Every day for the past year, Gale has dedicated at least a little bit of time to studying Nevada's medical marijuana regulation. He expects the first medical marijuana business to open by the third quarter of this year. But he predicted that operators will need at least $1 million to open a medical marijuana dispensary just to compete for a license. There are application deadlines, zoning restrictions and moratoriums that stand in the way, not to mention that banks are avoiding the medical marijuana business altogether. Last year, the Nevada legislature overwhelmingly approved a bill that would allow for 66 medical marijuana business licenses, with 40 inches Clark County. As many as 425 applications for services from growing facilities to dispensaries are expected. Because of the tourist draw, an ideal location might be near the Strip. But the Clark County Commission prohibited any dispensaries in the gaming corridor. It stretches from St. Louis Avenue to St. Rose Parkway along Las Vegas Boulevard and 1,500 feet east or west of the median, as well as property around Wynn and Encore. So how, exactly, does one enter Nevada's medical marijuana market? Under the law, four types of medical marijuana establishments are allowed: cultivation facilities, dispensaries, production facilities and independent testing labs. Clark County's intense application process looks like this. Preliminary review forms are due Tuesday. The deadline to submit an application for a special use permit is May 2nd, and the deadline to submit a copy of a deed or lease, along with a copy of an FBI background check, is May 9th. The commission set hearings for special use applications on June 5th. From that point, applicants must submit documentation to the state. A state registration certificate is provisional. That means, the applicant must return to the Clark County and apply for a business license. Once issued, then you can't open up for business. The Las Vegas City Council has agreed to move forward with allowing cannabis operations. But in January, Henderson passed a six-month moratorium on medical marijuana applications. For people who have significant funds available, it's not a problem, Gale said. But it is potentially harder for people who don't have a lot of money. This is a very capital-intensive investment. Because marijuana is still illegal under federal law, financial institutions are turning away marijuana companies. In February, the Treasury and Justice Department set guidelines for financial institutions taking on medical marijuana clients in states where the business is legal. Banks must review state license applications and look for red flags that could reveal illicit business, as well as file suspicious activity reports for questionable transactions from marijuana clients. If I misreport, I'm liable as a bank, said Bill Uffelman, president of the Nevada Bankers Association. So I'm putting my license to do business on the line so that you can do business. That's a hard mouthful for bankers to swallow. Gale expects financing to come from equity investors. Mark Tariq, an attorney who specializes in medical marijuana regulation, has been vocal throughout regulatory processes in Nevada and California, and he is working on ideas that could ease the flow of money into financial institutions. The first one that does it is going to be on the ground floor of a green rush, Tabig said. That's going to be the financial institution that will be at the forefront of the industry. One idea is proposing legislation that asks states to set up separate cannabis banks. Another prospect would establish a labor association for businesses in the cannabis industry. The labor association would set up sub-accounts for dispensaries and those businesses would pay dues to the association, which would do business with a state-chartered credit union. There's only so far that institutions are going to go to scrutinize their deposits, Tabig said. Even if medical marijuana funding is available, there's the issue of finding property for the business. A medical marijuana facility cannot be located within 1,000 feet of a school or within 300 feet of a community facility. In unincorporated Clark County, a production or cultivation facility cannot be within 660 feet of a residential property line. Under state law, the business must be located within a commercial, industrial or overlay zoning area. The owner of the medical marijuana establishment must own the real estate or have written consent from the landlord. Many landlords don't want medical marijuana establishments, Gale said. If they do, they could potentially increase the rent significantly because of the demand. Melissa Waite, an attorney who handles medical marijuana establishment licensing cases for the firm Jolly Erga Woodbury & Little, said landlords may be worried about how a medical marijuana business reflects on other establishments and whether it affects property value. They're looking to extract a premium from these operators because it is deemed to be a little bit more high risk than a typical tenant would be, Waite said. The disparity between federal and state law could also spell trouble for medical marijuana business owners shopping for insurance. The legal gray area may be the main issue of categorizing it, said Eric Springle, president of the insurance agency Orgill Springer. Last month, Jeremy Aguero, a principal with Applied Analysis, pointed to medical marijuana dispensaries as a significant source of revenue for Southern Nevada when he released the 2014 Las Vegas Perspective. It's like a gold rush out there to get those licenses, Aguero said. We have a lot of people interested in opening an operation here, and they're talking about investing millions of dollars into those facilities. Though he has not directly studied medical marijuana's potential impact, his company's comprehensive report gauges the economic direction of Clark County. There's a lot of cash chasing this particular opportunity.
Article number 4, The Misty World of Marijuana Stocks. Take it away.
The Misty World of Marijuana Stocks. By Joe Miller. Source, BBC News. One day, people are going to ask me how I became a millionaire, the wolf tells me. And I'm gonna say, from weed stock. The 35-year-old from Florida invests in U.S. marijuana firms, many of which are booming, and as the pseudonymous leader of Wolfpack, a rapidly growing Twitter community, he shares information about those stocks with his followers. His online persona, the Wolf of Weed Street, is a parody of Jordan Belfort, the corrupt New York stockbroker played by Leonardo DiCaprio in Martin Scorsese's recent blockbuster. Though the Wolf considers Belfort's character a scumbag, he likewise deals in stocks that sell for pennies rather than dollars, and that are big enough to list on major exchanges. Penny stocks are notoriously volatile and often loosely regulated, but unlike the film, in which Belfort makes his money through a series of boiler room scams, the Wolf's deals are entirely legal. Also unlike Belfort, the lupine investor doesn't partake in the product itself, although he confesses he used to, back in college. Green Rush. The firms to which the Wolf gives his seal of approval are mostly riding the wave of recent legislation that decriminalized recreational use of the drug in the U.S. states of Colorado and Washington. In what's been dubbed a green rush, investors have flocked to cash in on the new markets, causing stocks in cannabis companies to soar. I've made $515,000, $12,000 so far, says the Wolf, who quit his job as a disaster consultant in December after barely 6 months of trading in marijuana stocks. An index tracking the performance of marijuana industry stocks, in which only companies with a minimum market value of $1 million are allowed, soared by 125% in February alone, although it has since declined significantly. It is not just shares in marijuana growers that are blossoming. Companies selling a wide variety of marijuana-related products, from vapor inhalers to cannabis vending machines, are all seeing their stock rise. Even firms providing security to cannabis farms and warehouses are in the mix. How do Americans feel about legalized marijuana? Bangira. The movement in marijuana stocks has received attention beyond the Wolf Pack too. Veteran financial advisors, such as Todd Harrison, have been betting on cannabis being the next big thing since as early as December 2012. It's the single best investment idea of the next decade, says Mr. Harrison, who founded investment news website Mininville after making his name at Morgan Stanley and as the leader of a $400 million hedge fund. He likens the growth in weed stocks to the boom in the internet-based companies of the late 1990s, and plenty of investors feel the same way. I get inquiries from soccer moms, who feel they missed the boat last time around, says the Wolf, who jokingly refers to the marijuana boom as the Doug Bong era. But discerning the long-term winners and losers might prove just as difficult as in the 1990s. They will be the Ciscos and Microsofts that emerge as winners, says Mr. Harrison, referring to the dot-com survivors. But not before some firms get their feet held to the fire. Growing problems. Although Mr. Harrison is a cheerleader for the cannabis industry, he is not a big fan of many of the penny stocks currently driving the investment boom. The volatility of these companies has caused the U.S. Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, to issue warnings to investors over possible marijuana stock scams, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, was forced to suspend trading in one firm. Even the more stable and legitimate companies are struggling, having to convince banks, who fear drug racketeering charges, to take their cash. The Wolf, who at one point lost 60% of his fortune in one day, is realistic about the instability of many of the companies in which he invests. I've started to treat the whole sector like a giant game of Frogger, he says. I ride the wave and then jump. Shorting is a problem, he adds, referring to a process by which investors dump borrowed stock that they think is going to decline, then buy it back at a reduced price. Sites such as the Cannabis Financial Network CFN, which offers in-depth analysis of marijuana firms, are in high demand. The consultancy says it identifies legitimate companies that are well positioned to do well in the new markets, and favors firms with a publicly demonstrated business model, who make most of their money through sales of medicinal marijuana. Experts such as Alan Brockstein, a financial advisor who was an early adopter of marijuana portfolios, are also sought after by those looking for a foray into the foliage. I spent 6 months being negative, I saw a lot of shady business practices, says Mr. Brockstein. But there are newer and better companies now. There are better investors too. Most of Mr. Brockstein's clients are people who appreciate the long-term growth story, and don't partake in the herb, he insists. Like the end of prohibition? Ultimately, Mr. Brockstein, and his fellow weed stock enthusiasts, are betting on the marijuana market maturing soon, and they may well be vindicated. Medicinal marijuana is now legal in 20 states and the District of Columbia, with more states set to consider decriminalizing the drug altogether. Canada, another big market, is to make it easier for medicinal cannabis to be grown on an industrial scale. Tax revenues, which are much higher on recreational than medicinal marijuana, may also help the industry's legal battle. Colorado netted an additional $2 million.2 million in taxes for January after decriminalizing recreational cannabis on 1 January, while Washington State expects to bag $190 million in revenue by 2019. But whatever the pace of legislation, there is no doubt that attitudes to the potent plant are rapidly changing. It's no different to the end of prohibition, says Mr. Harrison. The stigma is starting to wear off.
All right, listeners, that's all I have for this episode. Till next episode, have a good day, good night, good week. Bye-bye.